heightened his resemblance to a hairy reptile. You got a temper, Navarre. Old boyfriend meets new boyfriend, sparks fly, things happen. I looked out the grimy kitchen window. Outside, the afternoon had officially begun, warmed up to about 105 degrees. The army of cicadas and the pecan trees had started humming. The two cops were still standing in broad sunlight in my front yard, melting. Every living thing with more brains than them was crawling under a rock or into the air conditioning to sleep. Then a second cruiser pulled up. This one said Bayer County Sheriff's Deputy on its side. I had to smile as a big man with flat-topped orange hair got out, frowning at the SAPD. My landlord was probably staring out his window, too, calmly shitting his pants. Jay, I said, I appreciate the extent to which you're fucking up this investigation. That takes real talent. I'm also impressed with the way you follow me around. Whoever's paying you for that should give you a bonus. Revis held up one finger, like a warning. Your dad was way smarter than you, Navarre, and he had more connections. Still, look where it got him. You should think about that. I drank my beer. I smiled in a friendly way. You're a piece of shit, Jay. My father scraped you off his boots 20 years ago, and you're still shit. He started walking toward me. I glanced behind him and said, If you've got a reason to arrest me, detective, I'd love to hear it. Otherwise, leave me the fuck alone.
Sounds reasonable to me, said Larry Drapuski.
Whatever Revis was going to do, he stopped himself. He looked around at Drapuski, who was leaning in the doorway. Drapuski was so big, I wasn't too worried about the AC escaping. His left palm was resting casually on his nightstick. In his other hand was the largest Benuelo I'd ever seen. It looked like a half-eaten frisbee.
Lieutenant, said Revis, forcing out the word. Can I help you with something?
Drapuski grinned. There was a coating of sugar around his mouth.
Just a social call, detective. Don't let me interrupt anything. I always like to see you city pros at work.
Revis snorted. He looked at me, then back at the door.
Maybe another time, he said. But Trace, you want to talk about your father, how he played around with people's lives, screwed their careers to hell? I'd be happy to have that conversation. You got a lot to be proud of, kid.
Then he started toward the door. And Jay, I said. He turned. Pick up the goddamn sword. It was worth it just to see his face. He didn't pick it up. He wanted to say something. I wanted him to say it. Then Drapuski said,
Goodbye, detective,
and moved his bulk out of the doorway. Revis took the out. When the door closed, Drapuski just looked at me, his bushy red eyebrows raised. Cautiously, Robert Johnson came out of the bathroom, lured by the shower of sugar and crumbs that was falling from the deputy's Benuelo. Then tried to climb Drapuski's pants. I don't think Drapuski even noticed. Larry took a thick bundle of police reports from under his arm and dropped it on the coffee table.
Wanna tell me about it?
Chapter 19. By the time I told Larry Drapuski my tale of woe, he'd relieved me of my leftover lemon chicken, four-shiner box, a couple of beef fajitas, and a box of the former tenant's Captain Crunch, dry. Robert Johnson sat on his lap, sniffing the food, but was careful to stay away from the big man's mouth.
Holy hell, Drapuski said.
He put his boots up on the coffee table, and the room suddenly seemed smaller.
Lillian Cambridge? As in Zeke Cambridge's daughter? I guarantee you, if this goes down as a kidnapping, this town will be boiling by tomorrow morning. That's some large dollars moving, son.
I'll give him this. The deputy got my mind off my problems. Now I was thinking about my empty refrigerator and my empty wallet. I was hoping to God that Larry didn't want something else to eat. If it goes down as kidnapping,
I said.
Drapuski shrugged. Just seems strange. I haven't heard about it over the telex yet.
Some kind of waiting period?
He laughed, sprinkling Captain Crunch across Robert Johnson's fur.
Robert Johnson vaporized from his lap and reappeared on the kitchen counter, looking indignant.
That's a damn myth, son. The network treats it just like an APB, puts it all over South Texas. You wait 24 hours to report something like that, usually the missing person is dead.
Then he realized who we were talking about.
Sorry, he said.
I swallowed. What about Guy White? Larry kept looking at me.
It was a damn stupid thing to do, pushing yourself in his face. You don't do that to somebody who's had as many people killed as Mr. White has. But if you're talking about your lady friend disappearing on Sunday, and you didn't see White until Monday afternoon, I know, the timing's wrong.
I must not have looked too convinced.
Larry leaned forward, lacing his thick fingers around his beer bottle. You know how many true abductions San Antonio has had in the last decade, son? I remember exactly two. Both kids. Neither had anything to do with the mob. If there was any suspicion of kidnapping, ransom demands, anything like that, the feds would become lead agency immediately. So I can only assume there's reasonable evidence to let Rivas keep this in-house. To stick with the idea that Lillian disappeared of her own free will.
Bullshit, I said.
Larry looked at me. You sure? It irritated me that I couldn't answer.
So why is Rivas on the case and into everything else I touch?
Drapuski raised his eyebrows. There's some fine, decent people at SAPD, honest cops.
And Rivas is not among them, I suggested.
Drapuski smiled. So, I said, either he's screwing with me for personal reasons, or because somebody's pulled his strings. But either way, he's screwing with me. Listen, son, Zeke Cambridge will get the police to do a damn good job, Rivas or not. Eventually, they'll have to bring the feds in on this, and things will happen.
Like they did with my father, I said.
Larry looked at me the way people do to somebody who grew up while they weren't looking.
He laughed again.
Holy hell, Trace. I don't believe you. That face you just made, that's your dad's shitlist expression, plain and simple.
There was such honest pleasure in his voice, I had to smile. For a second, it didn't matter that Lillian was missing, or that my father's murder was coming back like the worst acid flashback. You heard Drapuski laugh, and you knew there had to be a nice, clean joke in there somewhere. But it only lasted a second.
Car now and chef? I asked.
He didn't smile at that. He looked back down at the two photos I'd shown him, the ones with human figures cut out.
I don't know, he said. I'll look into it, but I doubt there's much to find. Either way, there's nothing you could do except sit tight.
I can't stay out of this, Larry. He did me a favor and acted like he hadn't heard that. Instead, he got up and appropriated the last Shiner Bock from the refrigerator. Then he found my tequila and brought that back to the table, too. We sat there listening to the cicadas and passing the bottle. Finally, Larry leaned back, stared at the bubbled molding on the ceiling, and started laughing under his breath.
Your father. You ever hear that story about the one bald fly boy?
Yes, I said.
It was my first goddamn time in the field, he went on. Found myself out behind an old ranch house with this screaming son-of-a-bitch Navy pilot wearing nothing but his Justin shit kickers and 12-gauge.
Drapuski laughed, scratching his acne.
He'd come home from Kingsville early, I reckon. Snuck into the sack naked to surprise his lady, and laid a big kiss on something that hadn't shaved in a week. By the time I got there, he was dragging his girl across the back 40 and hollering. He'd chased that Mexican salesman all the way to the property line before he shot him in the leg. The Mexican was just on the other side of the barbed wire with most of his thigh gone, bleeding all to hell. And this old flyboy couldn't decide who to shoot next, me, the Mexican, the wife, or himself. I thought right there, this is it, first and last day on the job. Then your father comes huffing up behind us like a Hereford bull, two more deputies behind him, and he just starts cussing out the fly boy like there's no tomorrow, saying, "God damn fool, why'd you go and let that Mexican get across the line before you shot him?" That naked pilot just looks at him, confused, and your father tells him, "You shoot him off your property, that's attempted murder, you idiot. You shoot him on your property, Texas law says that's trespassing." Then the sheriff pulls out his notebook and says, "I'm starting to write this up, boy. You best get that Mexican back over that fence before I get to my incident description." And you should have seen how fast that fly boy ran. But soon as he started, your father had his .38 in his hand. I never seen anything come as fast as that. First shot, blew the 12-gauge right out of the old boy's hand. Second one went straight between his legs and took his left ball clean off. Drapuski swore in admiration and downed a few more ounces of my Herradura. So the old boy jumps about 6 feet up like a shot jackrabbit and falls over. Your father comes up to him and says, "That first shot was for waving a 12-gauge at my deputy. The second was for being so goddamn stupid." After we got that Mexican fixed up, he sent your daddy a case of champagne every Christmas for 15 years. That was your daddy, Trace. The story had evolved a lot since I'd last heard it years ago, but I didn't bother pointing that out. I just took the bottle from Larry and finished it off. There didn't seem to be much to say after that, so Drapuski turned on the afternoon talk shows and waited while I read through the police files. Paperclipped to the coroner's report were three black-and-white pictures of something that had once been my father's body. The corpse looked massive on the metal table, washed out and unreal in the harsh fluorescence, like a stag caught in headlights. The exit wounds, two surprisingly small holes in his chest and forehead, were circled in black Marxalot. It took me a few minutes to focus on the words of the report after putting down the photos. But once I read them, there were no surprises about the cause of death. The other files traced a series of dead-end leads in the case. The Pontiac used in the drive-by was found among the burned-out shells of stolen cars that littered the west side each week, then traced to a retired butter-crust baker who had actually watched it get stolen from in front of his house. The baker told the police bitterly he just assumed it was another creditor repo and hadn't even bothered to report it. Things looked up briefly for the investigation when the old man tentatively ID'd the thief as Randall Holcomb, the ex-deputy who'd been arrested by my father for manslaughter, then been paroled a week before my father's murder. That line of questioning ended 2 months later in a deer blind outside Blanco, where Holcomb was found in a bloody fetal position with a .22 hole between his eyes. His body was badly decomposed by the time a local rancher stumbled across it, but the coroner estimated the time of death to be no more than a week after my father's. Heavy pressure on Guy White and the other known drug traffickers in South Texas, trying to connect them to the murder, yielded exactly nothing. White had gotten most of the attention. Every agency in town had conducted raids on White's properties, tied up his assets in court, slammed anyone who associated with him for the smallest misdemeanor, all to no avail in the Navarre case. Just like Rivas had told me, everyone suspected the connection. No one could prove it. The compiled list of my father's other enemies and Holcomb's associates also yielded nothing. Finally, the investigation turned back to Randall Holcomb. The revenge motive was nice and clean, the timing and the ID that connected Holcomb to the Pontiac very convenient. The fact that some other party had killed Holcomb was a minor glitch. Maybe Holcomb was killed for reasons unrelated to the murder. Maybe my father's friends in the department had gotten to Holcomb before the feds could. It had been known to happen. Either way, the FBI liked dead murderers, probably a lot more than they liked my father. They sold it to the press as a vengeance killing, classified the case as ongoing, and quietly shelved it. It was 8 o'clock, and getting dark before I resealed the folder and handed it back to Larry, minus a few items I'd lifted while his head was in the refrigerator.
My eyes felt like melting ice cubes.
Well, he said.
Nothing, I said. At least nothing that makes sense yet.
Yet?
Drapuski took his boots off the coffee table, walked stiffly to the refrigerator, then, finding it empty, decided it was time to leave. He took his gun and his hat off the table and stood looking at me.
Trace, Rivas is right about one thing. You don't belong in this.
Let them find the young lady. Let me look into Carnow and Chef for you. You put yourself in the way and it won't help anything.
My look must have told him something. He swore under his breath, then fished out a card and tossed it on the table.
Your father was a good man, Trace.
Yeah.
Then Drapuski shook his head, as if I hadn't heard.
The kind of man who could get you to take your own gun out of your mouth when you figured nothing else mattered.
I looked up at Drapuski's greasy 50-year-old adolescent face. He was smiling again, like he couldn't help it. Maybe I hadn't heard him right. For a second, I'd imagined him in a dark room somewhere, staring down a gun barrel.
You need something, he told me. Call that number. I'll do what I can.
Thanks, Larry. After he left, I took a lukewarm shower, then looked again at my father's notebook. I reread his notes for the testimonies against Guy White, the cryptic reminder at the bottom. Sabinow, get whiskey, fix fence, clean fireplace.
It still made no sense.
I closed the notebook and tossed it on the table. My girlfriend was missing. The other love of her life, who hadn't been a love of her life for several months, was driving around town with her business partner, and I was sitting on my futon reading my father's old grocery lists. I decided to make my perfect day complete. I called my mother and asked for a loan. She was, of course, delighted. I felt about as good as that fly boy who just kissed something hairy. Chapter 20. In my dreams that night, I was hunting with my father at the family ranch in Sabinow. It was Christmas break, my seventh grade year, one of the coldest winters South Texas ever had. The mesquite trees were bare as TV aerials, and the brush was a dull yellow-gray that matched the clouds. I was kneeling in an orange parka holding a .22 rifle my father had given me as a gift that morning. The barrel was slightly warm from 10 rounds of fire. My father, next to me, was also dressed in hunting clothes. He looked like a fluorescent tent for six. His Stetson tilted over his eyes so all I could see were his huge, bristly jowls, his nose webbed with red veins, his crooked, wet smile, half hidden by a battered Cuban cigar. The mist from his breath mixed with the smoke. In the cold, sharp air, he smelled like a good meal that was burning. Out in the clearing, the javelina still quivered. It was a huge animal, all black hair and tooth, much too large and mean to kill with a .22. I'd shot it first out of surprise, second out of anger, then again and again out of desperation to finish the job. All the while, my father just watched, only smiling at the end. Finally, the beast stopped dragging itself along the ground. It made a thick, liquid sound. Then even that stopped.
Meanest animal on God's earth, my father said, and the dirtiest. What'd you reckon you should do now, son?
He could talk like a Harvard graduate when he wanted, but when he tested me, when he really wanted to distance himself, he put on that accent. The familiar Cracker Barrel drawl was easy and slow, the way a cottonmouth snake is slow, moving towards you in the river. I said, "Can we use it?" My father chewed his cigar.
"You can fix up some mighty fine javelina sausage if you've got the mind to."
He let me take the knife and stood back as I moved up to the warm carcass. It took a long time to gut the thing. From the moment I touched it, my skin began to crawl, but I ignored the feeling at first. I remember the steam from the innards and then the indescribably bad smell, a sour blast of fear, rot, and excrement that beat the worst inner-city alley.
That was my first lesson. The gas that a newly dead animal exudes. It nearly knocked me down, nearly forced me to double over. But then I saw my father watching sternly behind me and knew I had to go on. I'd made my choice. After gutting it, I tied its feet and pulled it through the brush. Now the itch was intolerable. My father watched as I struggled to get the javelina into the bed of the pickup. My eyes were watering, my entire body crawled. Small red bites were breaking out on my arms like an acid wash. Finally, in desperation, I turned to my father, who was still standing a good distance away. In pain, humiliated, I waited to hear what I'd done wrong. When he spoke, it was almost kind.
"Every hunter needs to make that mistake once," he said, "and he never makes it again. You get too close to a javelina that's just shot, the first thing you get is the smell for a goodbye present, but that's not the worst."
He dropped his cigar butt and smashed it into the dirt with one huge boot. When he spoke again, the pain was crawling across my scalp, under my armpits, around my groin. It caused a dull roar in my ears.
"The body heat," my father said. "It cools off right fast, and all them little fleas, all them chiggers and ticks and every other form of varmint that breeds in that hide, looks for the nearest warm thing to jump onto." "You're it, son. Don't never approach a dead thing until it's cool as the ground, son. Not ever."
I couldn't ride back in the truck. I had to walk behind it as my father led me home. I spent one day in the shower, another day bathed in cortisone. And I'd never fired a gun since that Christmas. The other lesson, the one about avoiding the dead, had been harder to learn. Then the scene of the dream changed from Savanau to the A&M campus. I saw Lillian at 18, leaning in the doorway of her freshman painting class, barefoot, her hands behind her. Her denim overalls and her short, off-blonde hair were both flecked with red acrylic. A week earlier, we'd had another one of our epic fights. I'd stormed out of the Dixie Chicken in the middle of dinner. Lillian shouted at my back that she'd never talk to me again. Now, she just stared at me as I walked closer. When I came up to her, she brushed my face with her fingers, lightly, and left sticky red acrylic streaks on my left cheek. Then, keeping a straight face, she decorated the other side like war paint. She laughed. "Does this mean I'm forgiven?" I said. Her eyes turned bright green. She put her head so close to mine that her lips brushed my chin as she talked. Her breath smelled like cherry lifesavers. "Not even close," she said. "But you can't get rid of me. Remember that next time you walk away." The phone was ringing. I woke up sideways on the futon with the receiver already in my hand. The blinds above me were open and sunlight was pouring onto my face as strong and hot as gasoline. I squinted. Before I could make my voice work, Robert Johnson was on my head, talking for me.
"Murr," he said.
Maya Lee said,
"Oh good, Robert Johnson, you're home."
"Sorry," I croaked. "Should I get off the line?" She laughed. The sound was a hard one to wake up to. It brought back Sunday mornings on Potrero Hill, drinking Pete's coffee, watching the fog recede from the bay. It made me remember a city for runaways, where you didn't have to think about the past or home or who had disappeared from your life.
"You're a hard person to get in touch with, Trace," Maya said.
I sat up, knocking over the empty tequila bottle. Then I looked across the room and noticed the kitchen window. Maya was waiting for a snide remark. When I didn't offer one, her tone changed.
"Trace."
I walked into the kitchen as far as the phone cord would go. The rusty metal frame window above the sink was hanging wide open at a crazy angle.
Its bottom hinge had been nearly pried away, so the ancient turn crank that was supposed to hold the window shut could be stripped. "Trace," Maya said again, "what is it?" I sat on the kitchen counter and stared out into the crepe myrtles. A few of their pink petals were floating in yesterday's coffee cup next to the soap dish. A few more were smashed into the single, muddy footprint that was in my sink. No grooves, pointed toe, a large boot, maybe a 10.5 wide. "Maya," I said, "how much time have you got?" Chapter 21. I blamed Robert Johnson for not being a Great Dane. Maya blamed me for being a heavy sleeper. "I told you so often," she complained, "if a burglar had ever come in while we were sleeping..." She caught the "we" part of that statement a little too late. Her voice tangled on it like silk on barbed wire. When she spoke again, it was in her professional tone, careful and even. "All right, tell me the whole story." I told her what little I'd learned about my father's death. I told her about Lillian's disappearance, my talk with Guy White, the threats against me, Beau Carnow's mystery photos and his ride with Dan Scheff, the boot print in the gallery and in my sink. Maya was silent for a minute. Behind her somewhere, a foghorn sounded. "Did they take anything? These photos you found, for instance?" "Whoever it was came and left quickly. I don't think they were looking for paperwork. None of it was touched. Nothing else was taken."
"Not even your life?"
I tried to believe there was no disappointment in her voice. "It's nice to be loved," I said. After she'd fumed silently for a while, she said,
"Trace, your friend Drapuski is right. Leave this to the police. Get the hell out of there."
I didn't answer.
"But naturally," she said, "you're not going to."
I didn't answer. She sighed.
"I should have left you where I found you, tending bar in Berkeley."
"I was the best person you ever trained."
"You were the only person I ever trained."
It's hard for a Texan to argue with someone who insists on sticking to the truth. Robert Johnson jumped onto the counter and started smelling the boot print in the sink. He gave me an insulted look that was probably a close approximation of Maya's expression right then. Two against one.
"All right," Maya said. "Let's assume, even if I don't agree, that you pull on the two ends of this, Lillian's disappearance and your father's death, and you find out they connect somewhere in the middle. That would mean someone besides this dead convict,
Halcombe.
It would mean someone besides him was involved in the killing 10 years ago and is now nervous about your questions. Whoever it is, they're worried enough to threaten you, perhaps to kidnap someone you know, but not willing to kill you. Why?"
I picked a crushed crepe myrtle petal out of the sink and looked at it. Thinking about why I was alive this morning didn't help the empty, acidic feeling the tequila had left in my stomach. The half-memory of somebody looking down at me in the night had started to crawl across my skin like the smell of dead javelina and the sticky feel of red acrylic paint. "I don't know," I said. "Why does someone search the art gallery, then Lillian's house, then my apartment? Why does Dan Scheft hang around Lillian's front yard ready to beat up new boyfriends when Lillian's date book declared their relationship dead months ago? Why does Scheft give Carnow a ride? I don't know yet."
Maya hesitated. "Trace, I know you want to find the connection between this and your father.
But?"
"But maybe there isn't one."
I stared at the ceiling. Just above the stove, there was a water stain in the shape of Australia, bowing in the middle like it was desperately clinging to the bottom of the world. When I spoke, I tried to keep my voice even.
"You think I want it that way? You want it to be your problem and your responsibility to fix," she said. "I know you. But maybe Lillian was into something all by herself. It happens, Trace."
"I know you." The three most irritating words in the English language. When I didn't answer, Maya muttered a few curses in Mandarin. I think she switched the receiver to her other ear.
All right, then, she said. Let's talk about your father. Do you really think one of his political enemies could be involved?
For a moment, I envisioned Councilman Fernando Asante in an extra-large brown leisure suit trying to squeeze himself through my kitchen window. His Lucchese boot in my sink, his well-fed belly wedged between crepe myrtle branches. It almost cheered me up.
Even in Texas, the politics aren't usually that colorful, I told her. Asante, the most likely candidate, has enough trouble just keeping his dick in his pants.
The drug trafficker, then, the man whose house you so debonairly barged into at gunpoint.
I had to think longer about that one.
If it was Guy White, I can't figure his logic. Why murder a retiring sheriff, especially when you know you're going to get the heat for it? Now, why get nervous about me now when the feds couldn't find anything?
You don't sound convinced.
Maybe it's worth another visit.
She paused. But you can't just walk up to a mafia boss twice in one week and start shaking him down for information on assorted felonies.
I was quiet.
Oh, Christ, she said. Don't even think about it, Trace.
It's either that or retrace some leads from these police files I stole.
Excuse me?
Okay, you didn't hear it.
Christ, she said.
Rrrr, said Robert Johnson in sympathy. This is information about my father. I consider it an inheritance.
Insanity is your only inheritance, Navarre.
I protested. I work hard for my insanity, Ms. Lee. Nobody handed it to me on a silver platter.
How the hell did I ever fall for you? She wondered.
Things were awkwardly quiet for a while after that. Finally, Maya sighed.
Trace, I'm thinking about a time you were lying in an alley off Leavenworth with a Balinese knife in your lungs.
Grazed them, actually,
because you insisted on going to talk to a crazy hashish dealer by yourself.
It would have been fine if the illustrious April Goldman had been straight with me.
You would have been dead if she hadn't sent me after you.
Good old Terrence and Goldman. Your bosses must miss me, I said. A little more Mandarin swearing. Then Maya made her final plea bargain.
Is this friend of yours any good in a fight?
I laughed. Ralph, you mean? Ralph is a sneaky son of a bitch who fights about as fair as a cornered weasel.
Good. Will you take him along?
Ralph has business interests. He likes a low profile.
I don't want you going into this any further alone, Trace.
Maya, I'm not exactly living across the Bay Bridge anymore. She hesitated.
Then what if I were to come down there?
Silence on my end. What happened to a nice clean break? I asked. The quiet acceptance of my choice to move.
Maya thought about that. Have you ever known me to lie, Trace?
Only to get what you want. She didn't argue the point. I stared at the ceiling. I'll be fine. Besides, this is my hometown. They can't touch me here.
You're a true asshole, Navarre.
So I've been told. But she'd already hung up. I picked up an old Texas Monthly with Ann Richards on the cover and shook it. Ann revved her white motorcycle and dropped the notes I'd stolen from Drapuski's files. There were a dozen or so Xeroxed faces of men who had been under investigation by the FBI, various cons who were at large around the time of the shooting, some of whom had been put behind bars by my father and who possibly knew Randall Halcombe, the probable stealer of the Pontiac used in the drive-by. The faces stared back at me, telling me nothing. Finally, I took out the last page of Lillian's date book and looked at it again. At the third line, where she'd erased a phone number and a street address in the Dominion. I put on my best clothes, my Sunday visiting T-shirt, and my least torn jeans, then headed out to pay a call at the Chef family mansion.
Chapter 22. The Dominion is where your ordinary run-of-the-millionaire Texan dreams of going when he dies. George Strait lives there, along with a few congressmen, a few Howard Hughes types, and anyone else willing to pay 6 or 7 figures for a design-your-own mansion on a spacious lot of former sheep ranch land. No black sheep, obviously. It was a 30-minute drive from Queen Anne, 40 with the VW, fighting a hot north wind. As I passed Loop 1604, the land opened up, and you could see the storm coming in. Blue-black clouds rolled off the balcony's escarpment in a perfect line. The pastures turned dark green. A dry white branch of lightning cracked off from the sky and hit the horizon, then evaporated. I did what any sensible person would do. I put on my sunglasses. When I pulled up to the development gates, I stopped right in the entrance and got out to put up the ragtop. The condition it was in, it wouldn't stop the rain, but it might slow it down. And putting the top up here was just the kind of non-thinking thing a Dominion resident would do. Not rude exactly, just not realizing anybody else of importance could possibly exist in your space. 2 Cadillacs pulled up directly behind me and waited. Nobody honked. The security guard wavered in the doorway of his little booth, not sure whether he should yell at me or help me. I could be a rich person in disguise. I could be a friend of George's. I was wearing Ray-Bans in a rainstorm. I got back in my car and drove up to the guard, slowly. I tried to look mortally bored. "Hey," I said. He had a vibrating smile, this guy, like it would jump right off his face. He was younger than me, probably his first week on the job. The white uniform and his twitchy eyes made him look like the ice cream man after a nervous breakdown. "Your destination, sir?" he said, laying petal-soft hands on the car door. He tried to hide his distaste when he caught a whiff from inside of the VW. It had been doused by plenty of rainstorms before now, and some parts had never completely dried. "Yeah," I said, yawning. I snapped my fingers helplessly. I gazed off like I was having a flashback. Behind us, the Cadillacs were starting to get impatient. The one in front flashed its high beams. He had places to go, golf games to start. I almost thought it wouldn't work. Then the second Cadillac honked. The guard jumped. 200 Palamon? He offered almost in tears. "The Bagatellinis?" I grinned. "Yeah. Yes, sir. Straight up past the 9th green. Your first right." "Good deal." And I drove through, wondering who the poor Bagatellinis were if they kept sorry company like me. Maybe I should drop by. I'd been in the Dominion a few times before. Once, in the last days of their marriage, I'd been sent by my mom to pick up the sheriff when he was puking Cuba Libras into somebody's million-dollar cactus garden after a social hobnob. But I didn't know the place well enough to locate the chef house on the first try. After 2 passes around the Swan Pond, however, I finally found it. It was a modest place by Robin Leach's standards. 2 white stucco wings that met in a 3-story high point at the center. The middle portion, all glass, so you could see the Coliseum-sized living room and the interior balconies that looked down on it. The front yard was all rocks. I looked at the glass house. I looked at the million stones in the yard. I shook my head. The joke probably hadn't even occurred to them. Dan Sheff's silver BMW was parked a little ways down the hill. A brown Mercedes and a restored cherry-red 65 Mustang were in the driveway. So was an honest-to-God chauffeur, black suit and all, washing the cars. It wasn't his first week on the job. He met me at the curb before I'd even taken off my shades.
"Can I help you?"
He was a small Anglo man, lean and well-muscled, the kind of guy who's 5'5" with an extra 6 inches of attitude on top. The plastic sheen of his face told me nothing. He could have been anywhere between 30 and 50. "I don't think so," I said. "I usually wait until after the storm to wash my Mercedes." I've never seen anybody smile without making wrinkles somewhere on their face, but this guy managed it briefly. Then he was Mr. Impassive again.
"Thursday morning, like clockwork," he said. "I get paid anyway, man, and your business is with..."
Mr. Chef, I said. He gave me a quick scan from my triple rock t-shirt to my jeans to my deck shoes, which over the years, I admit, had come to resemble a pair of baked potatoes more than footwear. Mr. Impassive was not in awe.
Which one? He said.
Dan. He didn't even smile.
Which one?
Ah, a family with as many confusing duplicate names as mine.
Junior,
I ventured. If he'd said which one again, I would have had to flog him with my Ray-Bans. Fortunately, he just lied to me.
Not here, he said.
I guess he didn't expect me to buy it, because he didn't move. He kept his chest between me and the house, as if his chest were an obstacle at least the size of Kerrville. I glanced over at the BMW.
Dan's taking public transportation these days? Or maybe carpooling in the neighbor's Lexus to save gas? Mr. Chef doesn't make appointments at home, he said. Unless you're a friend.
The idea must have amused him. He made a small sound in the back of his throat that either meant he had a hairball or he was laughing. You'll want to talk to me, I said. Then I tried to walk past him. His hand wrapped around my biceps like a torque wrench. I tried to look suitably impressed, which wasn't hard. He liked that. The smooth smile came back.
No visitors. Unannounced, he said.
I stood still, offering no resistance. Not a bad grip for a guy who must drive power steering.
I benched 350 cold 6 reps, I whistled.
I drink 12 ounces cold 6 reps.
I mean it, man. You leave now.
I sighed, resigned. I seemed to think about it. No matter how strong your grip is, it's always unconnected where the thumb meets the fingertips, and the thumb is the weakest part of the lock. The trick is to twist against it fast enough to break out. It's really pretty easy, but it looks impressive. I was halfway up the sidewalk before he realized he didn't have me anymore. He came at me again, but he had a serious disadvantage. He was on the job, and I wasn't. In a bar fight, I would have thought at least twice about taking this guy on. But even the toughest employees are usually hesitant about cold-cocking somebody in front of their rich boss's house, at least not without permission. I had no such restrictions. He tried to grab me with both arms. I stepped underneath and flipped him into the gravel. Then I stepped onto the porch and rang the doorbell, or rather I pulled it. A huge brass chain that would have made Quasimodo homesick connected to some ridiculously tiny-sounding chimes. As if to compensate, a thunder-lightning combo exploded directly overhead. Raindrops as big and warm as poblano peppers started to fall. Meanwhile, the chauffeur was sitting up, brushing the white dust off his black suit. You'd have thought he got flipped every day by the calm look on his face. He just stood up and nodded.
Akito? He asked.
Taiji.
How about that?
Then he cleared his throat and looked at the front door.
You mind if I make the introductions, man? I don't feel like job hunting today.
You got it. I told him my name. For an instant, his face changed expressions. Then it smoothed over again. When Cookie Chef answered the door, the chauffeur told her,
Trace Navarre to see Mr. Dan Jr.
It only took the society matron a few awkward seconds to warm up her best smile. Then she held out her hands in welcome, as if I were late for tea and had been presumed dead.
Good gracious, yes, she said. Please come in, Trace.
Chapter 23
You'll have to excuse the house, Cookie Chef said. The maid doesn't come until noon.
Maybe the flagstone floor needed to be scrubbed or the walk-in fireplace vacuumed. I looked up at the ceiling fans 3 stories above. Maybe they needed dusting. Other than that, I couldn't see much for the maid to do.
Please, Mrs. Chef said, waving me toward the white leather couch.
I opted for a pigskin chair instead. Cookie perched across from me on the very edge of her seat.
Well,
she slid her withered hands around a half-finished Bloody Mary.
What can I get you?
Mrs. Daniel Sheff, Sr. had unnaturally golden, unnaturally smooth hair that fit around her head like a Roman helmet. Her bright red lipstick went well over the real boundaries of her lips. Her eyebrows were similarly enhanced. The makeup looked like a waterline that had been drawn at the height of a flood. Since that time, however, many decades ago, Cookie Sheff's face had receded. She was the picture of aging gracefully. Graceful if you didn't count the kicking and screaming and the surgery. She was also the woman who had been sitting in Dan's car in front of Lillian's house last Sunday.
I came to ask about Lillian, ma'am, I said. I assume the police have been by already.
The Bloody Mary froze halfway to her lips.
Lillian, she said. Police?
That's right. She shook her head, trying to smile.
I'm afraid I don't.
That would surprise me, ma'am, I said, unless you've sworn off phones since you were PTA president at Alamo Heights. The smile turned to stone.
I beg your pardon.
My mother used to tell me that you could boil every piece of gossip in town down to just 7 numbers, Cookie Sheff's phone number. When she spoke again, after apparently swallowing her tongue several times, her voice had all the charm and affection of a drugged bobcat.
Oh, yes, she said. Your mother. How is the old dear?
She looks great. Her drink was quickly reduced to red ice cubes.
Trace, Cookie said, taking on a patient, mildly chastising tone. Perhaps it should occur to you that a certain quality of people do not wish their family crises aired so openly.
Meaning I should have called instead of dropping by.
Meaning, she said, that the Cambridges are my very dear friends.
Soon to be family?
She looked satisfied. So you see why perhaps your coming here was not in the best taste.
I feel just awful, ma'am. Now, where is your son, please? She sighed quietly, then stood up.
Kellen,
she called. Mr. Impassive, already immaculate in a fresh black uniform, appeared instantly from an interior doorway, a full Bloody Mary in hand. He walked like he enjoyed the sound his boots made against the flagstones.
See Mr. Navarre out, please, Cookie said.
Kellen looked at me and nodded, maybe a faint smile. Permission to kill at last. Then on one of the balconies above me, Dan Jr. appeared, fashionably dressed in a maroon velour housecoat-looking thing. His hair was sticking up on both sides. I waved at him and smiled.
Dan, I called up. Thought we might have a talk.
His face compacted. Before he said anything, he looked at his mother, who shook her head.
What the hell do you want, Navarre? He said.
To find Lillian. I answered. You interested or not?
Danny, said Mrs. Sheff, do you think it's a good idea to talk to this man?
Her voice was soft, sweet, and cold as bluebell ice cream. Her tone implied that the right answer was no, and the wrong answer would probably mean no allowance for a week. Dan thought about it. Then he looked at me. I smiled, letting him see a little of my amusement. That did it.
Come on in the office, Trace, he said.
Then he disappeared from the balcony. The slight shake of Mrs. Sheff's head told me there would be a conversation at the family dinner table tonight. Then she gave me a look that was meant to suggest no dessert for the rest of my life. She took her Bloody Mary and exited up the nearest staircase.
Come on, said Kellen.
He led me into a smaller room, not much bigger than my apartment, really. Above the fireplace, on the right, was a recent oil painting of Cookie, minus the wrinkles. Opposite, on the left wall, was a huge black-and-white enlargement of a young Dan Sr., dressed for war, Korea probably. Directly between them, Dan Jr. pulled out the chair behind an oiled mahogany desk. Behind him, outside a heavily curtained picture window, a true South Texas storm was raging, brief and violent.
I could see my VW on the street, its roof fluttering, threatening to peel off. Small newly planted trees along the sidewalk were bent to the ground. "Have a seat," Dan said. He combed his hair, but was still drowning in maroon bedclothes. In his hand was a drink that looked like plain orange juice. I sat down across from him and waited. After a minute of staring at me, he said, "Okay. What the hell is it?" "You know about Lillian." Either he was a great actor, or his anger was genuine. His knuckles curled up white. "I know that you show up, and a day later she's gone." "When did you see her last?" Dan looked at me with red eyes, then looked down at the desk. He ran his hand through his hair, and a lick of blonde sprung back up like a canary wing. "You goddamn know when," he muttered. "And you were still there when I left. That's what I told the police. Not that they have a fucking clue. If it was up to me, you would have been put away by now, Navarre." "Danny," I said, "we agree about something." He made a sound like a bull's that's been zapped with the same cattle prod once too often. "Don't call me that. And we don't have shit in common." "The police don't have a clue. I agree with that. I didn't come all the way back to Texas to see Lillian disappear and then watch the police fuck up the investigation, Dan. Think about that." He didn't look very convinced. Shadows from the rain crawled across his face along with guilt, frustration, and some other things I couldn't read. He looked down at a more recent picture of his father on the desk. Dan Sr., the way I remembered him when I was in high school. A big man in fleshy clothes, the football team's biggest patron, or the cheerleaders, anyway. That was before he'd come down with his well-publicized cases of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Now, from what Lillian had told me, the old man was upstairs somewhere, silently withering down to a husk, while the best and prettiest nurses money could buy looked on. "There was a time he'd say something and the police would jump," Dan said, almost to himself. "You remember that, Kellen?" Behind me, Kellen said nothing. "Now, shit," said Dan. "They tell me not to get too worried. She might be out of town, they tell me. Shit." I thought about that. "Your mother said the Cambridges want to keep it quiet for a while, downplay things." Dan snorted like that was a good joke. "Downplay things," he echoed. I leaned forward and picked up the picture of his dad. The silver frame must have weighed 10 pounds. It was just about the coldest thing I'd ever touched. "Only child, right? If you don't count my 15 cousins. "And they're all dying to inherit a piece of the business," I suggested. "Must be tough on you." "What the fuck do you know about it?" His shoulders slumped. The anger in his face loosened up into melancholy. It was time to change tack. "What did Beau Carnow say to you yesterday, Dan?" I'm not sure what kind of reaction I was expecting, but it wasn't what I got. I've never seen a man turn molten red so fast. Dan was on his feet, and if the desk had been any narrower, he would have had his hands on my throat. As it was, he just leaned toward me and shouted, "What the fuck is that supposed to mean?" he spat. Kellen had come up next to me to monitor the situation. I decided it was time to stand up, slowly and calmly. "Look, Dan, I want to find the lady, that's all. You want to help? Great. You want to tell me Beau Carnow got a lift from the gallery in someone else's silver BMW yesterday around 1 o'clock? I don't have time to argue with you. Lillian might not have that kind of time." Dan stared at me. I couldn't tell whether his expression was incredulity or outrage. For a minute, we were all totally still, listening to the thunder. Then Dan shut down almost as quickly as he'd blown up. "Lillian," he echoed. The red trickled out of his face. He slid back into his chair with one long exhale. "Jesus, I need a drink." Maybe Jesus wasn't listening, but Kellen was. He took away the orange juice and replaced it quickly with a tumbler of bourbon. Instead of drinking it, Dan pressed the glass against his cheek like a pillow and closed his eyes. "Beau called me," he said finally. "He wanted some money. He He said Lillian had made his life difficult by leaving and he needed a few thousand as a loan. Why you? I asked. I waited. Dan moved the bourbon to his lips.
Things weren't always smooth between us, Lillian and me, he said into the glass. Sometimes Beau helped me get things back on track, flowers, telling me her plans, that kind of thing.
The crazy sentimental fool, I said. Dan looked up and frowned.
Beau's all right. He's been Lillian's friend for years. He would never do anything to Lillian, nothing bad.
I'm not sure who he was trying to convince, himself or me. Judging from his tone of voice, I don't think he succeeded either way.
So you agreed to see Beau yesterday, I said.
Dan looked up at me and said nothing. The rain was dying down, lightning flashed, and I counted almost to 10 before the thunder. Dan scowled as he drained the bourbon from his glass. Afterward, he looked up at me in surprise, as if I just appeared there. He seemed to ask himself a silent question, then nodded. He brought out a square leather account book from the desk.
How much? He said.
I stared at him.
I'll hire you, asshole, he said. Lillian said you did this for a living, this stuff. I'll pay you to find her. How much?
I felt a little slimy just for being tempted, but I shook my head.
No. Don't be a prick, he said. How much?
I looked at Kellen. Kellen stared back, his face about as expressive as sheetrock.
Look, Dan, I said, I appreciate it. I promise you I'll find her, but I can't take your money.
Then I turned to leave before I could change my mind.
Namar,
he called after me. I turned around in the doorway. From across the room, Dan looked about 10 years old, dwarfed behind his father's huge mahogany desk, drowning in oversized maroon robes, his blonde hair in disarray as if Dad had just come in and tousled it.
You know what it's like, he said. Living in the old man's shadow, I mean. You know about that, at least.
It was some kind of peace offering, I guess. Looking back, maybe I should have taken it.
Like you told me, I said, we don't have shit in common.
Kellen walked me to the door where Mrs. Sheff was waiting to see me off. That brilliant hostess smile must have been sitting in a glass in some other room, because when she spoke, she hardly opened her stern little mouth at all.
Mr. Navarre, she said, I would highly recommend that you avoid my household in the future, unless you are invited.
Thank you for the hospitality, ma'am. I stepped out onto the front porch. The rain had stopped and the clouds kept rolling south toward the Gulf of Mexico. 10 minutes from now, there would be nothing left of the storm but bent trees and wet cars drying in the sun.
I care deeply about my family, Cookie told me. I have a sick husband and a very dear son to look after, along with the reputation of the entire Sheff family.
And a rather large construction firm. She gave me the slightest sour nod.
I will not allow our family or our friends to be dragged through the mud.
One question, ma'am, I said. She just looked at me. Are you normally a spectator at your son's fist fights? I asked. Somehow I would have thought you'd fight them for him. For a woman of good breeding, Cookie Sheff did an excellent job of slamming the door in my face. Chapter 24